Makun Sarma is a seasoned security professional with expertise in application security, security architecture, and platform security. As the head of product security at Chime, he leads initiatives in AppSec, cloud and infrastructure security, security engineering, and embedded security programs. Mukund is also passionate about advising security startups in data security and identity and access management. He joins us to share insights on proactive security, engineering culture, and the security tooling that's contributed to Chime's success. With a deep understanding of product and application security, Mukund offers valuable perspectives on building effective security programs that can be applied in your company today.
Coding more securely from the start saves your organization time and money while protecting yours and your customers' data. Security Journey provides hands-on secure coding training in an application sandbox that allows developers to identify, break, and fix common security vulnerabilities. Give your developers the opportunity to recognize and prevent common and emerging security issues before they become a problem. Visit securityjourney.com to try our training today.
Hey folks, welcome to another episode of the Application Security Podcast. This is Chris Romeo. I am co-host of podcast, but today flying the plane solo. I'm the CEO of Davichi, also a general partner at Kerr Ventures, and I am excited today to have Mukund Sarma joining us. Mukund, we have to jump right directly into your security origin story because we don't believe in any warm-up time or warm-up questions on the AppSec podcast. It's all about getting people to your story as fast as possible. So how'd you get into this world of security?
Yeah, thanks, Chris, for having me. It's my pleasure to be here. I've been doing security for about almost 10 years now. Started as a software engineer working on the crypto side when crypto didn't mean currency. It actually meant like building protocols for the government of India back then. I was working on a few key sharing schemes with them. Soon moved to the US to do my research and my master's here. And then got into the space of application security, which I found it to be way more practical and pragmatic. And to be honest, a lot more fun. The chaos was something I enjoyed. So started working on AppSec, started with consulting with Synopsys, wanted to go get a lot of exposure with a lot of projects initially. And that's kind of what I did for a while. Then I moved to Credit Karma, where I was their one of the first few AppSec engineers building out the entire program there with, and also eventually helped build out the security architecture kind of program. Been there for about 5 years. And then I moved to Chime, been here for about 3 years. I am the senior director for product security. So everything security and engineering is what I work on. So application security, infrastructure security, security engineering, or platform security, some people call it. And also a new function called the embedded security program, which hopefully we can speak more.
Yeah. So did you start Chime's product security team? Was there a team there when you got there, or were you one of the early people who was tasked with, hey, put a team together here?
No, my boss, Jeff Trudeau, he was a CISO. He was here already, and he had hired quite a few people. Arkady, who was the security architect here, he was running the application security and infrastructure security folks. There were about like four to five people. But then when I joined, onboarded a new team called security engineering and then made that whole function as product security. And the team's about 22 of us, including two managers, mostly mixed with a lot of software engineers, a few SRE engineers, and a few like security AppSec engineers. But primarily building like developer tools is kind of what the team does.
Now, do you use the words AppSec and ProdSec as synonyms of each other, or do you think of them as different things? Because this is an interesting question, and a lot of people are in our industry are answering it in different ways. Some people say, oh, they're different. Other people say they're exactly the same. So from your perspective, you're a practitioner who's doing this in the field. You use both of those terms at the same time. Are they synonyms for you, or are they different?
They are, and I think application security is a sub-team under product security for us. So what I mean by that is we are building, we're adding controls, we're adding tooling, we're doing building a testing program, all of that stuff from the application security side, but we're also building features that our members will use. We are also securing the infrastructure side of the house that our product is built on top of. So there are other components into the product security program, which like the application security program is like a subset of things.
Okay. Yeah, I like that that definition and that approach as product security and then AppSec sitting underneath it as a function, because to your point, like, is infrastructure security AppSec? Well, it's not really an application. And for so many years, we've bundled everything together and we've called things applications and functions applications that really aren't. So great to get your take on that, because I know you're living it. You're in the trenches kind of being a part of it now. I know that proactive security and engineering culture are things that I've read that you've described for what your approach is at Chime. And I'd love to hear more about what do you define as proactive security and engineering culture?
Yeah. I think if I were to boil it down to one word, it would be collaboration. And I think that is how I look at all of this. It's like we strive towards more collaboration instead of the best security function or anything in that sense. I think more often than not, what you see end up with most security teams is they burn the bridges between the various functions because they're trying to get out the best and the most secure product out there without actually realizing it's all part of the collaboration process over years. Like, you are working with the rest of the business to make sure that what they do, they understand the risks of it, if they're adding anything risky in there. And if they're not, at least they know who to reach out to if they want like bounce ideas off and work things in there. So I think, yeah, like the one, if I were to boil this down to one word, it would be collaboration. But to go a little more deeper, it would be like also looking after, not necessarily being the approver per se, because I don't think that'll scale. The way we have taken our approach is like, we are here as consultants for you all. And if you do want to run ideas by us, we are here to help you. At the same time, there are enough and more guardrails to make sure that it doesn't get completely out of bound. So it's kind of a good mix of both, I would say. So we don't really have a concept of you must get every design approved by us. Like, there's no concept of that. So even if you look at our ticket flows and like even nitty-gritties of things, it just says that the design was reviewed. We never say that the design was approved. Like, simple things, but make a huge difference for us, because it's like, I don't want people to realize it's like we're just helping them build things securely, but it's their responsibility. The minute it becomes the accountability and responsibility falls on security, then it's game over usually. Mm-hmm. Accountability has to remain with the people who are building what they're building.
So I guess I want to ask kind of the other side of the question then, from a governance perspective. Mm-hmm. How do you govern an environment that is gives people the freedom and security is acting from an advisory perspective? Where does the rubber meet the road from a governance perspective? Because I love the idea. That's, for me, what you described has always been the perfect state. That's how things should be. But then the realist in me says, how do I govern the people that don't want to say or aren't doing what they're supposed to do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this is where I was talking about the other guardrails part of things, is like, we have built platforms and services and frameworks for the rest of the developers that are building to use our frameworks or libraries to do it the right way. For example, one project we just recently launched out is service-to-service authentication and authorization. It may sound very naive and basic and 101, but we have hundreds of services that are deployed in prod, and each of them were doing it in their own way, in their own format, which made it hard for us to even audit and authorize. Like, is the authorization even working? So what we did was we build this platform level solution where all the developers need to do is define one JSON config file to say what's the route, what's the method, and who are the allowed services. And then we take care of authentication and authorization for them. So all they spend is about 5 minutes, and we give enough and more instrumentation and observability to say, this is who are calling you. Do you actually want them to allow them to hit your endpoint, or is this a misconfiguration, things in that sense. So that's another like a guardrail kind of thing. So now we've seen like people want to use our solution because it's the easiest to get out into the, to be mm-hmm. a part of the ecosystem. Even if they could do it, yeah.
That's the Overwatch? Is that the Overwatch?
No, this is the service-to-service platform. Overwatch is our authentication platform to look at how, to look at the code and changes being introduced into the ecosystem. So for example, our most of time is GitOps driven, like I want to say 99% of it. So depending on what the context is, okay, are you adding a new Ruby controller? Then we go scan a bunch of Ruby scanners and then leave inline comments to your GitHub pull request. If there are issues.
I want to come back to that, but you introduced something I didn't even know about. So now I want to understand that better. So you called it, was it the simple services?
Service to service authentication and authorization.
Okay. Got it. So here's the question I have for you. And I hear that and I think, okay, this works at Chime because, and I think it's because you have a single, is it a single product ultimately that you're delivering, or are you able to do this across a multi collection of individual products?
Yeah, we can do it across multi. So we have services written in Ruby, Python, Golang, things deployed as Kubernetes, things deployed as Lambdas. So regardless of how you deploy, where you deploy, you can use this function.
Okay, but it has to be, it's within the context of a single stack, though.
Correct.
So that's because I think, you know, when I hear about things like this, I always love to try to give folks that are kind of in different contexts a perspective from your opinion. Like, if I'm in a bigger company that say has 10 different product lines, right? Yep. And could I use this same concept with, and maybe they're not all that, maybe they're not single stack, maybe they're using different, maybe one of them's written in Java because it was older and something else is written in Ruby on Rails because they migrated to something that was modern and they wanted to use a modern yeah. framework or something. Like, how would you see that playing in something that's not a single kind of stack approach?
Yeah. So I think to clarify, we also have a similar problem. So we have mm-hmm. things written in Ruby. We have things written in Golang. We have things written in Python. We have things written in the Node ecosystem. So all of them still can use our solution because ours is at the platform level. So what happens is it's a sidecar deployed to every app. That sidecar is the one that's doing the authentication and authorization. So regardless of what you're written in your application, you can still get in your authentication and authorization function in this case.
And so the real benefit is authentication and authorization of a service has really become transparent for the developer exactly. because they don't exactly. have to do a lot of thinking. Exactly. They just have to put a couple of lines in a JSON file yep. and then your engine for authentication and authorization does all the rest for them.
Exactly.
So I got to imagine they're loving it because you're making their lives easier. So is this part of the key to success though, is making developers' lives easier versus 100%. Adding friction?
No, 100%. It's about building a lot of developer tools. I hate calling security tools. I keep calling it as developer tools. Building a lot of developer tools, building a lot of self-service portals, all in the realm of adding enough and more guardrails. So you do want to make sure that no one accidentally opens up something. At the same time, you make it easy enough for people to do it. For example, in the same solution, there are ecosystems where a particular endpoint needs to be available on the edge, right? And that means if it is available on the edge, that means if the authentication and authorization is open. So the way they do it is they explicitly add a new field to the JSON file to saying that this edge access is equal to true, and then our platform will not break it for them. Whereas if they didn't have that flag set, then by default, all the connections to that endpoint is denied by default, unless and until they explicitly have that enabled. So this is where we're adding enough and more guardrails to the ecosystem to say that you can still go do what you want to do as long as you're explicit about it and you know how to do it. And this is how you do it. So
this is the first time that I think I've really understood guardrails. Like, I've understood it theoretically and I've understood the goal. But this is the first time I've actually had an example where I'm like, okay, this actually makes sense. And you're making developers' lives easier because you're building a developer tool, not a security tool. It's a developer tool, and no developer is going to say, no, I'm going to write my own authentication and authorization because I want to spend 2 weeks on this instead of 5 minutes making McCune's JSON file that he's defined for me.
Yep. And also everything around it is like very low latency. We do it under 1 millisecond. So people don't even see it. They don't even realize that it's happening. We allow multiple different environments. So if you can have a different config for your test versus your dev versus your prod, non-prod, all of these ecosystems can have different configs depending on how you want to set it up. So, and also dashboards, a lot of dashboards. Your Datadog dashboard, observability, everything to say what's happening at every point.
So what if I accidentally create a service that doesn't have a JSON config file? Do you just kick it out and it doesn't get to production?
By default, everything is locked down. So if they're just, so every, we have something called a service launcher that we have built with our infra team. So we are, like I said, we have hundreds of services. So every time someone wants to go create a new service, they go through the service launcher, and that service launcher has all your security defaults. Pretty common practice nowadays. And by default, you get an empty JSON config with only an health endpoint, which is required for the platform to know if the service is healthy, but every other endpoint is not configured. So what it means is every other endpoint will not be taking traffic unless until someone actually goes and edits that JSON file to have that in there.
Okay, nice. Yeah. All right, well, I've already learned a lot, but let's keep going. I know I've heard about and read about this Monocle tool. Yeah. And so let's go there next. Because I want to understand what is Monocle.
Yeah. So it's a gamification platform where in order for us to reach out to every service owner and tell them, hey, go do this X for security reasons or go do this X for compliance reasons, we've set them up as security score factors. For context, when I first started, right, we were just getting started on this. So one of the first few things we added was, does every repository have their main branch protected and has at least one reviewer? Like, it may sound stupid, but when you start off as a security team without that being a function previously, that is important, right? So you start off with that, and then you say, okay, do you have your SAST enabled? Do you have Dependabot enabled, or whatever is your SCM tool? Like, all of these could be score factors that you keep having in there. And then soon, as you mature your program, you can add more and more factors to it. Another thing is, like, now we say, are your critical and high findings patched within SLA? Are you not running as a root user in your container? Are you things in that sense? So all of these are score factors now that we have kept adding as we mature our program. The trick over here is to make it simple enough, very bite-sized work, things that a developer could spend less than 2 hours on to get that task done. Because the minute you make it too hard, they lose the momentum. They lose that energy of wanting to go and do that particular task. So what we have done is we have taken all the heavy lifting, created runbooks, created examples, guidelines for people to say, this is how we do it. And then we make that into a score factor. So last year, we migrated all our containers to run as non-root, for example. So the way we do that is we give them examples of how we do it in different tech stacks and how you can achieve this. So we could get adding that as a score factor, made sure that everyone went and did it, because if they didn't, then the score would be bogged down and people want to stay on top of the leaderboard. So people want to get their A, they want to get their A plus. So they will keep making sure that all the security requirements are met in that.
Yeah, John Doerr in the famous OKR book, Measure What Matters. Like, this is what you're doing. You're measuring what matters to the business from a security perspective. So many questions about the score, but I'll limit myself to just a few. So you mentioned SAST and SCA. Do you have a set of tools that are, do you have a stack of AppSec tools that influence my security score, or do I have some freedom as a developer to use maybe Bandit for a Python? If I'm writing in Python, can I use Bandit as open source static analysis, or do I have to use something you give me off the stack?
You can use anything you want, but we will always have something that we want. So okay. you as a developer can go to whatever you want to, but at the same time, we will have a list of things that we will run and we will make sure you adhere to. And that is through the score factor part of things.
Okay. And you provide those though. If I'm a developer, you're providing that stack to me as a set of tools that will influence my security score result.
Yes. Yes. And for example, that is what Overwatch does. It's like, instead of people having to measure and keep track of every single thing and every single scanner to a language tech stack and make sure the rules are configured and which roles are enabled and maintaining, basically what we really wanted to solve with Overwatch is not having to maintain hundreds and hundreds of CI configs all across various repos. And every time you have to change one thing, you have to go modify everything else. So we created one GitHub app that runs as an orchestrator, and you can just maintain that configuration in that GitHub app. And that app is run on every single repository. And the context is handled at the runtime by the orchestrator here. So it's like, okay, you're Python, you can go run Bandit, and here are the rules. Similarly, if you have something specific for yourself, you can enable those particular rules only for your repositories, for example. Hmm. And we let developers maintain these if they want to, but we give them a standard set of defaults by default.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about gamification and the impact that it has here. Because I know it was a hot topic a few years ago. It kind of got a little cold, but it seems like it's warming up again as a topic here. And so how do you use gamification then? And you already gave us a little bit of a preview, and you said people are driven to want that A and A plus on the scorecard. But tell us a little bit more about gamification.
Yeah, initially it was just purely, how do you get visibility out and how do you get people to know what's even matters? And while we were talking to teams and building those relationships, this was good enough of a place to start with. You know, it's not too big, it's not too overwhelming. People know what exactly needs to be done. So they'll be like, most engineering managers are like, yes, I want to help security. I want to do the right thing, but I'm going to spend only X amount of time every quarter or every sprint to do that. So tell me what I need to do. And then that is the minute most teams get this right is because at the point of tell me what I need to do, they don't really have a good list of what needs to be done. And that's what we get Monocle to tell them is like, this is how you do it. And you're required to have at least a B or higher, because if you don't have a B or higher, that'll go back to reporting. And no one wants to see look bad in front of their own bosses or things in that sense. So it started as a PR, let's report on it. We've also played around with the idea of having it part of people's bonuses. Luckily, everyone has kept it above their score so far, that it's never actually hit anyone's bonus so far. But that's another thing is how do you actually drive some of these changes by having it part of the leadership's bonuses? So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the ultimate gamification play is money. It's some cultures support it, some organizational cultures that I've seen support it, and others don't. But it is the ultimate driver of behavior. If you attach it to bonus, everybody pays attention. And I've seen other organizations that have done that. And guess what? It gets a lot of attention because everybody's talking about it. And all the senior leaders are asking people on their team, what's our score right now? Where are we? Because they're calculating their bonus at the end of the year or whatever as a result. So it works.
We are also part of the engineering monthly review. So one of the factors there is security and seeing how everyone's scores are and who is below. And this is part of the CTO's group. So it has a lot of visibility in there.
Are there any negative challenges in scoring applications like this? I'm just trying to think if something is so good for a culture and so positive, there's always something that can go wrong with it though. And so from your perspective, is there any negatives to this?
Yeah, I think so. I think one which we early on realized was if there were tasks that are bigger than let's get this done in under 2 hours, people are not going to they'll be like, it's not part of a Monocle score. Why do we do it? Kind of a thing. And that's kind of where you have to talk to them and hope that your relationship with them is good enough for them to realize why you are doing this or what is the ask. but also like showing them that you are willing to help by sitting with them, pairing with them, things in that sense, that has helped a little. But I think it becomes a very, here's the things of list of things I need to do, but those are very tactical, and not sometimes not everything is tactical. You have to like sometimes rebuild something ground up, for example, or help the, like we need to work with the platform team to help them add security controls on them. And those are not going to be a 2-hour set of words. They're going to be pretty bigger. So how do you get some of that bigger chunks of work in? Because we treat Monocle as KTLO at this point, as like just doing the right things to make sure you have the right minimum security score. But we want to go above on that. We don't want to keep always at that minimum score. So that is one. The other one is there are going to be services or attacks that are deprecated or old and just having to wait to get that deleted. So no one's actually going and adding new features, but it still serves as a critical function. So how do you keep those minimum set of things done in there? Because I can't say go rewrite this whole thing to use our new platform control, because they're like, they're not going to rewrite it. So
it's a big task, right? It's not like it's a 2-hour task. It might be a 2-month task.
Exactly. And maybe they don't really have the skill set for people who are there anymore. Like all they know is how to keep this up and running. That's all they know about it. So that how do you there's a lot of exceptions to this policy. Is like, okay, depending on the context, we rescore you. So we also like the scoring mechanism is not just pure binary. It's a lot of context in there. It's like, okay, are you serving external endpoints? Are you treating member PII, things in that sense, and all those factors go into like how your service gets scored. Mm-hmm. So we can play around with those tweaks, but that's part of the gamification also.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I could see now I'm kind of seeing the light, like you could be stuck in that, just to summarize, you could be stuck in that situation where people are like, that's not in the security score. So sorry, Mukund, can't help
you.
I'm focused on, I'm keeping my score at an A+ because I like getting an A+ on my test. But what you just described is not on the test. And so add it to the test if you want me to have to do it. So, yeah, I guess that is a little bit of a, there's some push and pull in that type of a challenge.
Yeah. Also, sorry, one last thing is I think I would say if you don't, like, I think our gamification was hitting a challenge if it's just like keeping on top of the leaderboard, right? There's no other, like, that is good and exciting for a while, but why else is it important? Like, why else is it needed there? So you need to like look at what are your other ways of adding to the whole gamification process. And I think for us, it was the bonus part. It was like a percentage of the bonus is tied to it. But if you can't find that, then your gamification dies. That spark of gamification dies quickly. So you have to find newer ways to keep that in. So.
Yeah, there has to be a motivational lever in the equation, right? That causes people to pay more attention to it and quarterly can circle back around because they're looking at how much their bonus is going to be impacted by it. Yeah. So just to help people kind of close their thinking on the security score here, if you could throw out just a couple of examples of things that go into the score. I know there's a lot of things. We don't need to go through all of them, but I don't want people to leave this conversation and go, yeah, I kind of think I knew what they were talking about, but I didn't really grasp what types of things you would be scoring.
Yeah, we've actually written 2 good blog posts on it. We can drop it in the description here, but I think let me talk about 2-3 of them. One is like, are all vulnerabilities for this service patched within the SLA or critical and high vulnerabilities? As long as they're patched within the SLA or they're still within the SLA, they get full 100 points for that particular factor. Okay. Second factor could be, is a service running as non-root in their Docker container? Third one is, have they patched their image in the last 2 weeks or in the last 1 month or whatever frequency that you define? It could just mean as much as using our base golden images and then them having to just redeploy once in every 2 weeks or once in a month. Most people do that often.
The changes. Yeah, so they get the changes out of the golden image that you've already done the work for them with the base images as far as patching.
Yeah. So these are like some 3 things. We can go more and more. Like I said, as you mature your program, you can add a lot of more factors and remove factors that don't make any more sense. One other factor we spoke about is the service auth. Is the service using it? So that is another way of actually getting them to use it because it's part of the escrow factor. So.
Yeah, but over time, you'll reach a point where everybody will be using it new services will get it by default because maybe that's it's they're forced to add it by default. And so I guess you reach a point where everybody gets 100 points. And so maybe that's a good measure for when do we retire things from the score. Because if everybody gets 100, and then we should pull it out of the score.
Exactly. Yeah, that's how we do it today.
Okay. Very cool. Very cool. So let's transition and talk about embedded security function, because I'm curious about that. And it's we're feels like we've been in the technical side, in the tooling, in the culture. I think the embedded security function kind of is going to bring us to the people side, kind of melding together with the culture. So a lot of attention on security champions these days, but let's give us a definition. When you say embedded security function, what give us a definition of that as a start?
Yeah, we have different domain engineers part of the security team, but working with the different domain teams. So what I mean is I do have a data security function at Chime. So what that means is I've hired a data engineer who actually didn't really have a lot of security experience, but we hired her. She's part of my team, like she reports to me, but is working with the data orgs to make sure the data security function is built up and it is pragmatic and it makes sense and it actually adds value to their development lifecycle. So that's one example. I think more often than not, it's easier for us to teach other domain engineers the security concepts than the other way around. I'm not going to have a lot of love trying to get someone, a security engineer, and prioritize them how data engineering or data science concepts are done and how is Kafka built and deployed or how is streaming done and how is your ML models built and deployed, all that kind of stuff. Whereas if I do hire someone who knew all that, that is their domain knowledge, and taught them the security concepts while I'm supporting them or the team is supporting them with that, it's much more effective in this case. One, because more often than not, I've seen is like if it was the other case where we did hire a security engineer, the recommendations are not practical or pragmatic. It doesn't make sense for the data team to even be like, yeah, that doesn't make sense for us. That does make sense when you're building like Java services and deploying it, but it doesn't make sense for us. Like, that's not what we do. We are building a platform here. You don't understand how ETL is done, or you don't understand how transformation jobs are written. That's kind of the feedback we've always gotten. So what I've done is we've hired domain engineers, then they report to security, but they are part of the data team in this case. Mm-hmm. So they take part in their stand-ups, they take part in their demos, they take part in all of those things, but they report back to me over here. So that's the concept of marriage.
How did you choose the order of embedded security people to add? Because I could see a organizational problem. We never have enough resources, right? Even on security teams, it's not like we have an unlimited, we can just hire one of every department to be here. So how did you prioritize, this is the first person I need, this is the second person, and then these are the people that I'll be able to add in the next coming years?
Everything is risk-based. Everything we do over here is risk-based. You want to see what is the biggest risk for the company, what is the biggest risk for the program, and then try to see how do we try to attempt for it, and what's the best ROI here. For example, the data one, I think we realized that we needed that because one, we didn't have that expertise on the security team. So we were actually burning bridges every time we tried to have a conversation with them because they were not talking the same language. And they actually also needed help to understand what it is and also probably even help pair with people on the data team to do the job because it's not an easy enough thing. I think as an AppSec or a whole security team in general, as an industry, what we have tried to handle things purely from the AppSec point of view. It's like, okay, if people are building features, if people are building services, then we have enough and more like education, tooling, resources, all of that stuff in there. But we have not done justice for the data ecosystem, for example. Like, we don't really treat data engineers or data scientists as first-class engineers for the most part. That's what is the reality in most in teams. So there are no good OWASP top 10, or there is no good tools to get a model deployed and build periodically or things in that sense. So I feel like we need to like reinvent some of those paradigms in the other domain knowledge. So to answer your question, I think it's purely risk-based. So for us, we thought this is what made most sense at this point of time. So we hired that person.
Okay.
I do have another person in the, part of the data embedded security program that's part of a different platform team that we are building at Chime. And they are trying to learn and help the whole money transfer part of things done securely. So that's a whole different data. It's a whole different domain where they need to know the integrities of how a processor works, how is the how all the money transfer aspects work, and then help them secure it. So it's a whole different domain. It's a whole different side. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if a let's say somebody listening here is thinking to themselves, this embedded security function, this sounds like a good idea. I want to do this inside of my company. What would be some advice you would give them for somebody new who's trying to take this thing, this concept you've already done, had some success with? What would be your advice to them on how to successfully move forward?
Make sure the domain team wants it. Otherwise, don't do it. Mm-hmm. That is the main thing, right? You have to talk to the leadership there. You have to talk to the team there. You should make sure there is appetite to even start some of this work in that whole problem of space, and then start looking at it. The other thing you want to do is not challenge their people. In that case, for example, you want to make sure there is no like a shadow data team within security that's trying to do their job. Like, we all hate shadow security teams, shadow IT teams. Similarly, even those people hate shadow data teams that are people who are trying to go to a data in this case. So, for example, so you need to make sure that relationship, that understanding is there, that you are just trying to help them, but it's really that they are the data domain experts, and or they're the domain experts in this case, and then that we will be working with them to make sure that's done the right way. People who start off without that can really, like, this can backfire really well, like, really quickly, if they don't pay attention to that aspect. The other one is, do you have the appetite is also important. Is like, because I think what you realize is like, there's a lot of handholding. There's a lot of work that needs to go in. And does you and your team have the appetite to do that extra work? Because, like I said, most of these domains haven't really had that level of engagement with the security team or with a thing in that sense. So you'll have to find paradigms of things that are normal to you, but explain that to them and work it out. So it's a lot of work on your end. So I would say those two, and definitely the person who you hire, right? If it's a more junior person who hasn't had experience doing, even working in a normal security function, forget the cross collaboration, then you're not setting up for them for success. So just be sure and kind of people you hire. That is also important.
Yeah, some more skill sets on the cross collaboration front seem like that would be, which kind of leans itself towards more of a mid-level experience to a senior person, because they're going to be, especially in the early days, they're going to be front and center in front of that team. Like, there's going to be a lot of things are going to be determined in the first month or two when the team's trying to feel that person out. Like, oh, is this person from security just here to look over our shoulder and report back on all our failures? Is that why they're here? Or there's building up that trust where the data team in this case feels like, okay, this person is here to help us. They're not trying to find our flaws. They're trying to help us secure our data better. They're not telling us what to do about the stuff we're experts in. They are only offering suggestions based on their security knowledge and how it applies to our domain. So I could see that being one of the key things you got to watch out for. Cause you could, if you get a bad relationship going in the beginning, forget about it. They're going to cut you out of meetings. Like, oh, we forgot to invite you. Sorry.
Yeah.
So what do you see as the future state of this, this embedded security function? Is this something where the security team of the future, let's say the ProdSec team of the future, half of the people are distributed security team or are embedded security people, where your team is really just a whole lot of dotted lines? Is that what you see as the future state, or where do you see it going?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think there's definitely work for some of these domains for the next like 2 to 3 years. But then I think once they have embraced this, once they know how the function, like how to pair with security, how do we work together, there might actually not be a lot of value for that particular person to be that embedded into that model anymore. They can come back and work with the security team. They can work with us to build more toolings, functions, things in that sense. They can also be part of a different embedded program and a different team in this case or something in that sense. But I also feel like you want to make sure that there are two things. One is that person doesn't become the person to do all the security vulnerability patches or things in that sense. You have to be very careful of that to say that, no, my role over here is an advisor, as a consultant. I will pair with you. I will work with you, but you're the one going to finish it up if needed. And the other one is being in an embedded team is actually very lonely. And you should be careful of that as a manager or someone who's trying to lead that function, is because the rest of the security team has people to work with and talk to and things in that sense. Whereas this person can feel they're neither part of this team nor the domain team. So you have to make sure that there is room for like this person to grow and engage and be part of a bigger function too. So you want to make sure that that is also a very tricky part. Like if you don't get it right, you can feel very lonely as a part of an embedded engineer. And also like simplify the process sometimes. For example, you don't want to have them go through 2 sprints planning or 2 retros or 2 different things because they're part of 2 different teams. So you got to simplify some of those aspects for them. Like those are more nitty-gritties, but they make actually a huge difference for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, I love to hear you describe that because that just shows you're an empathetic leader who's thinking about your people. And that's a trait I wish we saw more of in all industries of people that, you know, are thinking about how am I going to hire the best people, but also how am I going to have them here 5 years from now? And just as excited about what they're doing in 5 years as they were the day they walked into the building. And that's, but your description there of considering and thinking about their experience and everything is just, it's a powerful message because it just shows I'm going to guess people like working on your team. I'm going to make a guess. But if that's how you're thinking, the best teams I've been on have been in my life and my whole career have been where the managers actually cared about the people and they get out of the way and let them do what they're good at, which just sounds like these are two things that the teams you build are doing those things as well.
Thank you.
All right, let's do some lightning round questions. I could spend the whole day talking about the things we've talked about already, but you know, we got to summarize it. We're gonna link some blog posts where people can get more information about the nitty gritty details of Monocle and some of the other things you've done at Chime. But let's do some lightning round questions and have some fun with these too. So, first lightning round question is: what is your most controversial opinion on application security? And you have to say why you hold this view.
I think regular software engineers are way better AppSec engineers than AppSec engineers, because I would say that, why do I hold this view? I think they know their domain much better and they know their aspect much better. And it's so much easier to teach people the security concepts than the other way around.
Okay.
I know a lot of people will hate me for that, but that's my controversy.
And you can reach Mukund at PO Box 102. Sioux Falls, Idaho. I don't know what. Don't send anything there. No, I think, you know, I think that's a fair assessment. I think if people have experienced leading teams that have seen people come from different trajectories, I think they agree. I've seen people coming from multiple trajectories, and I agree. I would rather have a developer and then layer AppSec on top of what they're doing versus going the other way around. Because it's not that controversial. Because I've been yelling at people like everybody should learn. If you're in security and you don't know you don't have a single coding language, you don't have knowledge of a single coding language, and then you're an AppSec, I'm sorry, you can't say I'm an AppSec engineer. Developers, I want to help you. That language you code in, it's not really for me. I don't know it. Sorry, but do this and do that because I said so. All right, now I'm getting into my controversial take. I took over your segment there. I'm sorry. How about if you could have a billboard message at the RSA conference or Black Hat conference that had like a single message on it, what would that message say?
collaboration greater than security.
Ooh, I like that. That's a good sticker right there for a laptop sticker. Okay, how about recommended reading? Any books that you like to recommend to people? Any favorites in could be technical or non-technical, doesn't matter.
Technical, maybe the Building Secure and Reliable Systems by Google. I think that's a very pragmatic, practical book and makes you really understand how complex systems are built and deployed. I think that's a really good book. Non-technical, I would say I'm more of a nonfiction kind of a reading person. So right now I'm reading this book called Drive by Daniel Pink.
I've read it. Great book. Great book. Love it. Very cool. So, Makun, how about a key takeaway? What do you want to leave our audience with? Do you want to give them homework via call to action, or do you just want to, how do you want to end the conversation?
Yeah, I would just say like people to be like, think more from the developer's perspective, think more of what, how can you enable people to do this right? And try to relate this to how you can get your engineering or your developer function to be more accountable for security and not you be the driver or the owner, because the minute you are the one responsible for it, you just can't scale. Usually it's a 1 to 150, 1 to 200 kind of a list of people, like one security engineer for every 200 engineers, and you just cannot scale that way. So I would say think more from how can you enable them to do this right instead of you being the gatekeeper.
Very cool. Well, thanks, Makun. Thank you for sharing your wisdom and insight into building teams, building programs, building tools. This has been a really excellent experience for me. And so we look forward to a future conversation in some months where we can dive into something else that you're focused in on. So thanks for being a part of the Application Security Podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Pleasure is mine. Thank you.